Here we are. So we're just letting some people come into the room. For those of you who are in the room, welcome, welcome to what I think will be a very busy LinkedIn audio. We've had our most ever acceptances on this one compared to any of the others that we've done. This is our 8th LinkedIn audio. And yeah, big interest in this. So thank you for joining us. And yeah, I'd like to welcome Neil Wilkins, who's going to run us through the 5 business and personal lessons to learn from the Japanese. So welcome, Neil.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you very much for having me on this particular event.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of interest in it. So let's see how many people join us. There's still a lot of people joining us. We're going to kick right off. The one thing I will say is I'm always happy for people to come on stage and speak and ask questions. I'm going to hang that off at the moment. I've got one person asking if they can come on stage already, but I'm going to hang fire on that at the moment because we want to kick this off and start talking first. And then as we go along at the end of each one, I'll ask people to come on if they've got a question to ask or something to comment on. So Neil, thank you for this really interesting subject. And I'm just going to dive right in and say that when I looked at the 5 areas that you had forwarded to me, I'd only heard of 2 of them. I'd heard of Kaizen, and I can never say the last one. How do you pronounce it? Ikigai?
We always have this conversation. It's Ikigai.
Ikigai.
Yes, my favourite topic.
Of Kaizen. Yeah, I've heard of Kaizen. Ikigai?
It is, you've got it.
In fact, I use Kaizen a lot. I had read a book as well on Ikigai. So I knew about those 2. The other 3 I had no knowledge on at all. So we're going to jump right in with the first one, which was Sonki. Now, I did do a little bit of research on this, and I do understand that it's about being respectful in business and in life. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more. And I do want to prefix before we start, these are big subjects, and these are subjects that we could probably talk a good hour on each one. So this is just an overview that we're giving as to what they mean and how we can apply them into our work, personal life. And if you're interested in what Neil is saying, if you quite like the sound of that one, it's something that you may then want to go away and have a little look into a bit further. So Neil, Sonki, respect. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, this is a very interesting one for me because it's one of those things that I have been doing, I guess, forever without even realising it. And I think a lot of these concepts that we are kind of going to be talking about in this session are probably like that. Probably a lot of these things, if you're listening to this, will be things that innately feel just right. And so the concept of Sonki is very much about respect. And when we talk about respect, particularly in the Western world, what we're talking about generally is respecting others, so other people. But the concept of Sonki is a lot deeper than that. There's a real kind of nuance here, which I'd like everyone to start really thinking about, is the question of how much you respect everything. Not just people, but everything. So okay. Items, objects and things, well, basically everything has an innate energy to it. So therefore, you will get back what you put out. So if you really, really concentrate on respecting everything, that is the mug of coffee that you might have sat on the table in front of you, that is the bunch of keys that you throw onto the table as you come into the house, and really actually you should be gently placing those onto the table so as to give respect to the keys and the table, etc, etc, etc. I mean, I found as a child growing up, I kind of did this innately. I kind of looked out for things. This might sound rather strange, but I would talk to objects because I felt that they would kind of almost resonate and talk back to me. So the concept of Sonki is very much about this respect for everything you encounter. Obviously, that does include people, but a really interesting little nuance is think about the things around you. And I guess when we talk about things, it is about wherever we can, particularly with, you know, this very, very sensitive situation we have in terms of sustainability at the moment right across the planet. you know, there's never been a better time to really consider the respect of all the things that, you know, come into your world that you own, that you, you know, have encounters with. Because if we can do that, then that could be a little step forward in terms of our own personal contributions to, you know, a more sustainable world going forward.
Oh, I like that. I mean, I think, as you said, we're all pretty understanding of the need to be respectful of others. One thing I was reading up about it is in the Japanese culture, this is very much also about being respectful in the language you use. So they're quite big on using respectful language. But I didn't realise it was about the respect of everything in terms of items and objects too. So that's a really interesting concept. What do you know on it, Neil, about, as I say, when I was reading up on it in the Japanese culture, that they use this a lot when training their staff in the workplace, especially in terms of the language that we use?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is very, very much about, and this is something which, you know, is proliferated right across the planet, the concept of gratitude. And I think gratitude here for, you know, the other person, obviously self-gratitude. So being very grateful for your part in a relationship, both professionally and personally, but also really respecting and being grateful for the other person spending time with you. You know, culturally, there is a really kind of strong emphasis on, you know, the value of time and real appreciation of time. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in one of the other concepts in just a moment. But I think, yeah, when it comes down to this kind of concept or this idea of respect, it is about being grateful. So it is grateful for the things that you have, grateful for the people around you. And again, that comes through in a professional as well as personal sense. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, I like that. And I think any of us on the call who are parents are constantly saying to their children, you know, about being respectful of things. I don't know. You know, we're always telling children off, aren't we, when they don't respect the toys they have or they don't respect doing something. So I really like this idea of not just being respectful of others, but thinking of it on a wider scale of being respectful of other people, being respectful of the language we use, being respectful of items and objects, being respectful of yourself, being respectful of time, and just being overall grateful. I think that is a really nice concept to have. And I think, as you say, a lot of us are doing a lot of this already, but are we mindfully doing all of it? Probably not all the time.
And I think that is often the key, isn't it, really? It's about building these good habits. And I think one thing that's going to, as we go through all of these concepts and these ways of being, it is about developing and creating and then fostering good habits. So, you know, it's all very well for the next 10, 20 minutes going off and being respectful to everything. But the key skill here is to kind of constantly remind yourself until it becomes a natural thing. You know, some of us are just kind of made in a way that just feels easy, but for others, it can be harder. You know, I'm never going to say that I'm perfect at all of these things. This one does resonate with me personally, though. I do find it quite easy to be respectful. And you could argue, well, is that upbringing or is that innate in you? It almost doesn't really matter as long as you're, as you say, Tracy, you know, being mindful over it so you can create that good habit and then, you know, literally live in that way.
And I think that's a really key point. You know, some of people find this easier than others. I think in the Japanese culture, it is inbuilt in them. I think, you know, for me, I think I'm pretty good at being respectful of others. And I think I'm pretty good at being respectful of time. I think I have to catch myself sometimes maybe on the language I use. And I think maybe I'm not always respectful of or as respectful of items and objects as I could be. So I think we all know where we're good at this and where we need improvement. So great. Well, that was the first one, Sonki, something to start thinking about. Now, the second one, Kenshin, I couldn't really find much about this when I tried to look it up because I thought I actually want to be knowledgeable on the three that I don't know much about. And Kenshin was one that there wasn't much about. So I'm in your hands for this, Neil.
Yeah, this one is an interesting one because it is the more kind of overarching concept of dedication and focus. A lot of these words don't necessarily have a literal English translation, and for me that's what makes them fascinating, because there is a little bit of kind of translation that needs to go on. The way that I would interpret this, and others listening to this might have a different view, and that is totally fine. We're all coming from a space of, you know, respect and doing this, you know, with kindness, so it's all good. The way that I would really define this is that there is a cultural thing going on here that is, and a lot of people say, oh, 110% focus, 110% dedication. I've always got a problem with that 110%, because that's a real misnomer. That is something that simply doesn't exist. So let's be really, really pragmatic here and say it is 100% dedication. And this is in both work and play. There's no distinction of the difference really culturally here between work and play. It is in everything that you do, there is 100% dedication. So wherever possible, that is 100% focus. A lot of the time it will be dedication. And I would use the word here from a Western perspective as it's intention. Okay, so I might not actually achieve 100% perfect performance, but I'm intending to be dedicated at the highest possible level in work and in leisure at 100% dedication. In other words, I'm going to give this my focus. I'm going to give this attention. I'm going to try. We'll talk in a minute about being present. That's a really, really big one. But here, what we're just really focusing on here is that, okay, I'm going to go all in. So this isn't about going in half-heartedly. This isn't about making excuses. This isn't about, you know, not taking ownership and accountability. Because 100% dedication, and this one's important, just by definition means you have to take on accountability. So you're seeing the importance in something. That could be a relationship, a project, something that you're, a new pursuit that you're doing, you know, privately at home, whatever it is, you are going to give this your fullest attention and your fullest commitment, really. So you're taking accountability. And this is a really kind of overarching thing that I've been sort of picking up really through culturally, sort of from Japan here, is that this is, again, another thing you've just described, that Sankey is very much innate in the sort of embedded culture. I would say that this very strongly is. You very, very rarely see people who are succeeding, if you like, if they're not 100% dedicated. And it doesn't mean perfection. It doesn't mean they're getting it right all the time, every time. But there is this intention to achieve, this intention to commit, and this intention to be accountable.
Okay, and you know what? As you've been talking, it's kind of reminded me of two things that we talk about in other subjects. Have you heard of the Pomodoro technique?
Yes, I
have. That kind of links in with this, isn't it? The Pomodoro technique, when we're focusing on a task, that is teaching you to be completely focused and intentional for a set period of time.
And I think that becomes then achievable, doesn't it? Because, you know, this is a big grand thing. What, 100% dedication in work and in leisure? What, every waking moment could be the question that comes back. And the answer is, well, kind of. But it, again, if you chunk it, then it potentially is achievable. And, you know, using Pomodoro, I mean, it could be that you decide, I'm going to just chunk this for the next 2 minutes. So we're not looking at the next 3, 4, 5 hours. We're looking at small moments of time where I'm just going to give this my complete and utter dedication. I'm going to be accountable for what happens. I'm going to focus, and I'm going to enjoy that real kind of presence that brings. And then maybe extend that time outwards as you practice.
I definitely think the Pomodoro technique in a work situation can definitely, it will certainly help you with this. I also like this linking into having a work-life balance too, because I like the way you said it's 100% focus in work and play. And I think that's like really super important as well, to understand that you have to have a break and it can't be all work. And when we are in our personal life, that deserves as much tension as our business life.
Yes, I totally agree, and I think it is about balance. And I think you know, from, you know, all the global changes that we had over the last sort of couple of years. I think that there's been a real focus, you know, in whichever kind of country you're listening to this from and whatever kind of culture you're in, real kind of focus on balancing life. And life is a balance between work and play. I mean, it is. And I think, you know, this gives us, you know, the ownership of being able to take that accountability and, you know, get things to a level that, you know, is right for us personally, because not everybody wants to commit, you know, the same level of balance between work and play. Some people want to do more work. Some people want to have more leisure time. And I think it's about really just self-reflecting on what is it that's important to me, because this bit's really personal. It really is. You will define it for yourself.
Yeah, and giving that your dedication and focus as well, because I don't know about you, nothing drives, and I don't know about the people who are listening, but nothing drives me more crazy than when someone's talking to you, or when someone's watching TV, or when you're out for dinner and they're on the phone and they're trying to, they're doing two things at once. And that drives me absolutely crazy, because I feel like saying you can't be watching that movie and be on your phone, because you can't be focused on either one of them 100%, or you can't be eating dinner and talking to me and doing emails on your phone, because you're not focused on enjoying your meal or enjoying my company. And that drives me crazy.
And there is a lot of research which, you know, defies this concept of multitasking. You know, a lot of people claim that, but personally, I would think there's a little bit of an excuse going on there for just trying to be for all places at all times. So, you know, I think it's personal choice. And I think, you know, for some people, they'll say, well, I'd like to continue in that vein because it kind of works for me. And I don't think we're here to judge that. I mean, if some people want to live in that way, but I think there's a lot of evidence that says actually that probably isn't going to serve you particularly well, really.
Opposite of multitasking, isn't it? This is focusing on one thing, giving it your full dedication, and then having a break and moving on. It's the opposite of multitasking, really.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Right, I'm going to jump straight into Wabi Sabi. I've probably pronounced that horribly wrong. It could be Wabi Sabi, I don't know. And then I think after that, we'll sort of ask, has anybody got any questions before we go into Kaizen and so on. So Wabi Sabi, well, I had a little look at this because I didn't really know much about this either. But this was more about, and you'll have to tell me if I'm right on this, Neil, having a connected way of living, if you like, accepting what is, being in the present, trying to keep things simple. Have I got that right?
It is certainly about the keeping it simple. I think that would be the way that I would translate this. The word that often I kind of hear myself repeating back is this idea of minimalism. So keeping things super clear, keeping things really kind of pure, at their purest and most simple. So breaking things down. We live in a very complex and very chaotic world. I mean, you look at your social media timeline, for example, it's chaotic. It's moving at a rate you can't even keep up with. You know, you're working on maybe sort of multiple projects at work. You know, at home, you've got a whole range of different demands on you. The concept of Wabi Sabi is very much about minimalism. So again, we're looking at time here. We're looking at little moments, little snapshots in time where you give a focus onto something that's really, really precise and clear. So for me, the idea of minimalism comes into play here. And if you are a minimalist person or minimalist style, you may well have a very, very clear desk, if you like, at work, where you might have your computer on there, you might have something to drink, maybe your phone is by your side, but nothing else. And the concept here of Wabi Sabi is very much that gives you focus. The minimalism gives you that purity of attention and focus. And again, a lot of research behind this as being something that allows you then to really absorb yourself into that thing or into that concept or into that moment. And so from a Japanese cultural perspective, this would be something that is very, very important, because it's sort of interwoven with the two others that we've just talked about, to give that clarity, to give that respect to the thing that you're focusing on right now. And there's also something that comes when you start to talk about this into play with this, and it's the concept of ma. So that's M-A, ma. And the idea behind this is once you start to break things down into really, really sort of clearly defined things or activities or objects, and you give them your undivided attention, what you start to realise is there is a lot of space in between things. That can be space in between objects. And the concept of Ma is that there's a beauty and a purity in that space. So if you look around you right now, if you're listening to this, look at the objects, the things that you can see around you, whatever those things are. And what I'd ask you to do is then think about the space between those objects and actually look at the space between those physical objects. And that's what we're talking about here. And there's a really, really lovely moment when, if you're listening to music, and there's a lovely example, the Japanese flute player Adrian Friedman, who plays the shakuhachi, which is an ancient style of Japanese flute. And when he plays, he talks a lot about, yes, listening to the note that he's playing, but then as he lets that note just disappear into the ether, it's then waiting and listening to that pause before he plays the next note that is the beauty of the music.
That's
something to really kind of stop and think about. You can't do this at pace. You have to bring, to even sort of conceive of this idea, you have to really ground yourself and bring yourself down and stop and pause and really listen. Because the beauty of that space, be it between a musical note and another, where the one note just drifts away and you can almost not hear it, and then it feels like it's gone, but it actually, energetically and physically, is still there, but you can't hear it because you can't audibly pick it up before the next note appears. That little space, if you can wait for that moment, is a thing of absolute beauty. And it is actually more pure and more pleasant to listen to than the actual next note. So that's quite an extreme example, but you can just test this out by just looking at the objects around you and just having a real appreciation for the nothingness, the simplicity and the pure minimalism of the spaces between those things. And there is no way in this world, if you do this really intensely, that you could feel stressed over anything. So there's a lovely grounding sort of ability that you can have just in practicing appreciation and gratitude for those spaces.
And I think also what you said, this about the minimalism, this is a big thing in Japan, isn't it? If you look at people's living space, you know, maybe because they have a much smaller living space than us, but they're very much, and I'm just talking in a very general viewpoint here, but when you go in to somebody's homes in Japan, they're not cluttered. They don't have 27 pairs of jeans and 100 pairs of shoes, and they live a very different way to how we live here in the West.
They do, and there is, once you kind of realise that the purity and the simplicity and the clarity of that. So it isn't just a sort of a visual look and feel. Yes, there's a wonderful stylization around that. So yes, visually it looks beautiful, and particularly, you know, with things, you know, positioned, you know, just right. But there is a lot more, and this, I've used the word energy a few times here, and this is about the energetic flow of things and of moments. And there's something almost that you can't put your finger on. There's almost something that language can't define as to the reason why that works. And it is this concept of Ma. It is the space between things that you just, as a human being, just can't really quite define. But you just know intuitively it's right and it's grounding and it's pure. And there's just something lovely in that not knowing.
We just don't need all the stuff we have. We don't need all the stuff. I think your mind is clearer. Mine certainly is. I don't know about anybody else on the call, but when you have a good tidy out and a good clear out, you feel better, your mind feels clearer, you feel more focused about things. You don't need as much stuff as we have. You know, we can live a much more minimalistic life. The other thing I read up about on this, and it's something I just wanted to pass this by, it's something I also watched a program about recently, is this also is about the fact that perfection is not achievable and imperfection is okay. We don't have to be perfect all the time. And I watched a program about these this pottery in Japan, and it's sort of like the cracked bowl pottery, and it's where in ancient times when things were broken, people saw the beauty in the fact that they were broken, and they sort of glued them back together with gold fixings, if you like, and that's become a great gold scars, because they don't want to hide the imperfections on them. They want to celebrate the imperfections on them. And, you know, that falls into this space too. What do you think about that, having the foresight that, you know, we can't be perfect, and actually something that is imperfect is just as beautiful and just as valuable?
Yeah, from a personal perspective, I've learned this one in, I would say, probably quite recent years. I think like a lot of us, you know, just things that are nice and just clean and tidy and they look new and shiny have a beauty to them. Of course they do. But actually, it's the stories, as you quite rightly say that, I think, you know, it's the stories behind the imperfection that are actually quite interesting. It's taken me many, many decades to kind of get to realise that. So some of these things, you know, you pick up really early on and you think, yeah, that makes sense. But some of these things don't come until later in life, and you don't realise actually the story behind that crack or that imperfection or that vulnerability or that kind of admitting you were wrong, you know, all of those things. There's a wonderful kind of storytelling thing going on behind that. The Japanese have another phrase called shogunai, which is letting go of what you can't control. And I think there's this lovely vulnerability that comes through in, you know, examples like that, because, you know, if you can't control it, don't try. I think a lot of stress and a lot of angst in the Western world comes from just trying to kind of just keep control over everything. And I think we just have to accept there are things in our life, in our world, work and play, that we just have to give up, or we let somebody else be responsible for, because it's outside of our jurisdiction or it's outside of our remit. And that's fine.
I think
that's
a really important point, that you can't control everything. I think it's also a really important point that not everything is perfect. Some things have imperfections, and we live in a throwaway culture. And, you know, we're all trying to be more environmentally aware. And certainly in the Japanese culture, they don't discard things like we do. The wabi-sabi concept is, you know, can we fix it? Can we turn imperfection into something beautiful? I don't think we have that mentality so much in the Western world, and we're going to need to, because, you know, we live in a throwaway culture, and that has to change.
Yeah, and I think that there is evidence of that emerging. I mean, whether it will come in, you know, in this style, but I mean, the whole concept of circular economy and circular business now, where, you know, there is kind of recycle, upcycle, you know, reuse things, and maybe not actually be a consumer. I've had for a number of years now a real issue with just the word consumer, because a consumer used to be customer, but actually now it's somebody who's just consuming. The concept here is to kind of challenge that and say, can I repurpose this thing? Can I rework something that actually isn't completely broken? It's just imperfect, but that's fine, because there's a story behind it. And it's almost kind of embracing that and saying, it's good to have, you know, this imperfection in our life, because it reminds us that we are all broken, we're all partially damaged, and let's celebrate that, not kind of, you know, misuse it, really.
Big subject, really, and we've had patiently waiting on stage, Suram.
Can you guys hear me well?
We absolutely can. What do you, do you have a question or something to add?
I have something to add.
Great.
I come from, you know, Indian background. I live in the USA, but I come from Indian background. So some of these concepts that you mentioned is not new, right? It may be, Japanese maybe say it in a specific way. Mm-hmm. We Indians say it in a different way, and it's all the same, right? Yeah. So in my understanding, Sankai essentially means, in an Indian way, it is being in harmony with nature. That is, right. You respect everything, you know, whether animate or inanimate, that is, whether living or non-living, you respect everything. You basically believe every object serves a purpose, and you respect the object for the purpose it serves. For example, we talked about the coffee mug. The coffee mug serves a purpose. It lets you drink coffee in the morning and lets you get on with your day. And mm-hmm. if the coffee mug is not there, you know, you're going to find it difficult drinking the coffee. So yeah. that is this idea of being harmony with nature, is every object has a purpose and you respect the purpose of the object, whether the object is high in stature or low in stature.
Yeah.
So to add to that, the Indian philosophy takes it a little further because we have seen a lot of mocking from the West mm-hmm. in terms of the food consumption habits of a majority of Indians who are, mm-hmm. You know, vegetarians or vegans. You can kind of call them vegans, because if you talk about Sankhya, how can you respect nature? How can you respect every single object and kill and eat the same object? So that is where veganism comes. I will not take any animal byproduct because I respect the animal. It has every purpose living in this world that I have. So I will not get involved in killing an animal and consuming it. So that is why, you know, I practice veganism. So that is one way to look at it. Because if you really practice Sankhya to its highest level, you know, you should not be a meat eater. Because mm-hmm. the very fact that you eat meat means you kill an animal and you impose your will among it. It is very difficult to understand for a Western audience, but there are reasons behind it. Because if you think about your Western world or Western and Eastern philosophy are widely different. Because Western philosophy always thinks that as a man, I need to find answers. I can find answers for everything. I can understand this world. I can understand how this world was created. I can know where we are going. That is the Western philosophy. But the Eastern philosophy is more spiritual. It understands that something is beyond my comprehension. It understands that there are some things that I am not going to understand or I am not going to comprehend. Or there are some things that I will only understand once I reach a certain spiritual level or certain maturity. So that is the difference between Eastern and Western. And if you think about India and Indian monks, they never really went after science. You know, science was not the pursuit. Spirituality was a pursuit. So if a person who is very intelligent in ancient India, he will go to Himalayas, he will become a yogi, he will seek God, he will, you know, do all the spiritual things. He never went after science, right? So this Western philosophy is going after science, finding out, you know, what exists, finding out what we know. I'm not saying Western philosophy is wrong or Eastern philosophy is wrong. I'm just saying there is a difference in the approach of.
And I think you've come up with some good points there. I mean, we're not really focusing. There's definitely some similarities between all the cultures, what we're talking about. We're focusing on the Japanese and how we can apply that into our world today. But as you said, there's some very, very good similarities to your culture, to our culture. I will say, I don't know about Neil, I'm pretty sure you're vegetarian too, like myself, are you, Neil?
I am indeed.
You are. So you're in good company here. Neither myself nor Neil eat meat either. But we're only able to touch on these subjects today. Obviously, we could talk at great length on all of them. We're just giving an overview of those, but I appreciate your comments that they are very similar in all cultures. We might have different names for it. There's different levels of this. But, you know, even if we can learn something new today and, you know, start thinking in a different way and go and do some more research on it, it's been worthwhile listening. And I'm going to move on now to my favourite one of these five, and that's the Kaizen principles. Something I have known, I lived by and worked with for years and years and years. So the Kaizen principle is something that we use a lot in my particular company because we deliver Lean Six Sigma training. And Kaizen is all about continuous improvement and change. And it's a massive part of the Lean Six Sigma qualifications and courses that we run. So very, very, very familiar to me. Neil, over to you and Kaizen.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from Kaizen perspective, the idea of continuous improvement, I want to kind of extend it out beyond the working sort of practice into kind of everyday living, I guess. I mean, this is something that is, you know, is very pertinent, I guess, in these times. is that literally in every pursuit, the whole idea of, you know, not seeking perfection. I think the earlier contribution there from Sriram was really interesting in terms of kind of sort of each culture has this kind of idea of what success means. I think within the Kaizen concept, it is that the actual journey of continuous improvement itself is as important as the eventual outcome. So success comes from, you know, the beauty and the kind of the art of the process as much as from, okay, but where did we end up? How successful were we? Are we at the end of the project or at the end of the campaign or whatever it is? And so for me, the concept of Kaizen is to actually celebrating the journey as much as the eventual outcome. And I think that's a really important one.
And that is exactly what we do with the Lean Six Sigma courses. We say, you don't go to the solution. You don't go to the end point. You go back to the start and you plot and take apart and rework the journey. And that's exactly what that's about, Neil. And I couldn't agree more. There are five areas of Kaizen. Knowing your customer. So that's looking at the value that your customer brings and the value you give to your customer. Certainly in Mean Six Sigma, we call that the voice of the customer. Anything to add to that, Neil, about knowing the customer and the customer value?
Well, I think, I mean, again, it sort of ties in with everything else that we've talked about here, which is this constant awareness and actively listening. I think the idea of active listening has got a very much Western feel, but it is intrinsic in all the things that we've been talking about here. You can only have the voice of the customer and share that back into the organisation if you've actively listened. And I don't mean listening with your own kind of lens on, listening, you know, with your own perspective. It's actually listening and admitting when, as an organisation or as an individual, you've got it wrong, or that you didn't get it quite right and you need to learn and you want to learn. So it's genuinely putting yourself in the other person's shoes. And that is critical here to getting that bit right.
Yeah. And then stage two is let it flow. And by that, it means aiming for zero waste. That's the lean part of the Lean Six Sigma. In that, we call it, if you want to look that up, it's called mudda. And it's about just trying to not be wasteful, really, looking at the process and trying to be as wasteless as you can. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, again, comes back to when we were talking about the minimalism. We sort of putting the business sort of angle on this, we often sort of find ourselves, you know, with a lot of legacy stuff. If we're in an established business, I mean, you only have to think about, you know, the amount of systems that you've got and processes which are legacy from previous years. And it's about kind of, like, do these still serve us? Do these still serve the purpose that we have and the process that we're in? So being, you know, really honest when it's time to retire certain parts of what you do. Because, yes, they had a purpose at one time, but now that purpose is served and so we can move on. And it's not trying to cling hold to things. It's allowing things to, you know, find their natural end.
To just flow with, you know, what's right for now. And as you say, waste doesn't have to necessarily be a thing. Waste can be a system, it can be a process, it can be anything, it can be time. But what are we doing that's wasteful? Is there a better way of doing it? The other thing, point three on Kaizen is Go Gemba, they call it, which really is just about exactly what you said at the start, Neil, knowing the process, following the process, working with the process and not against it. In Lean Six Sigma, we call that the Gemba flow or the Gemba walk.
I think from a customer perspective, I think there's a bit of a focus on customer here at this moment for those in a commercial sense. I'm really passionate professionally about the whole concept of customer journey. And I think, you know, we can often assume the journey that our customer's going on with us, you know, with our products and services and the support that we offer the customer. But our assumptions are often not accurate because of the legacy stuff that's gone before or that we've just added some stuff in, or we've taken some stuff out that the customer liked. So really, really understanding from the customer perspective how our products and services look and feel, and the experience of them is critical. But so few of us actually do it in practice. We make assumptions that are often just not correct. So that's important.
Yeah, and the fourth stage on this is being transparent, and that means in the data, having tangible data, and being visible with it so that everybody can see it. And that, and that's the whole process that we cover in Lean Six Sigma for sure, which obviously is based on a Japanese principle. It is that, you know, we teach people various ways of data analysis and defining and analyzing things, and being very visible and open with that data so that people can make informed choices.
Yeah, for me, the word that we used a couple of times earlier on, which was vulnerability. There's a lot of, in the West, a lot of kind of ego-fueled decision-making, I would say, you know, where it's kind of designed to make us feel good, to boost us up. And a lot of the time, the better method of decision-making is to actually be vulnerable. Vulnerability, if you listen to the great commentator on this topic, Brené Brown, and she'll talk a lot about, you know, the strength and power of vulnerability. So being really open and honest with yourself, your team, your management team, you know, and actually making decisions from the heart, but with honesty, using an honest interpretation and evaluation, rather than, oh, well, we can't decide that or admit that because it makes us look weak. That is not a weakness. Vulnerability is a real strength. And then again, a lot of evidence coming through that, you know, organizations who are making decisions in that way are the ones that are really, you know, making great gains right now.
And I think the last thing in this kind of links into that, it's empowering people. It's giving people the power to not be an organization, or to not think that you are the only one who has the knowledge or the ability to change things, you know, to empowering people to have the right tools and the authority to be able to make changes. And this, for me, is crucial. When we run our Lean Six Sigma cohorts, the companies we deal with quite often say, who do we put on them then? Should we put our senior managers on them? And I say, no. You put people on them who have a good mindset, who have the right mentality. Because I can tell you now, out of them, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, you know, we've qualified in terms of Lean Six Sigma, the ones who come up with the best ideas, with the best processes, with the best changes, with the best, you know, ways forward, are not senior management. They're just people doing an everyday role in an everyday organization. And the fact that they've been empowered and given the tools to make changes, they are the ones who succeeded the best.
Empowerment is so critical. And I'm sure if anyone's listening to this and you are a business leader or decision maker, you'll know that when you've delegated stuff to empowered others, you get the results back. Because it comes back to the Song Key thing right at the start here. It's about accountability. It's about people really taking ownership for stuff. And then they will respect it more. So the decisions that are made will be respected and will be really followed up in a really positive way. You know, it's almost the superpower for business, really. If you can get to that level of interaction and professional relationship, I often use the phrase professional intimacy, and if you can, you know, get it to that level where you both sort of, all of you within your team, really have a deep understanding of each other's drivers, presence, responsibility, who's accountable for what, there's a real kind of acceptance that if you get it wrong or if you're struggling, it's okay to say. And again, I think this is a real strength of that process, is that it's okay to admit when it's not working. Because you're on this process of continuous improvement, that gives you something else to improve. So it isn't a weakness, it's another opportunity. And yeah, I love it. I love it when it's done that way.
We use this in all our trainers, in all our training courses. We use it in time management courses. I use it in sales courses. You know, it's one of my favourite things to be able to say to people, let's have a look at what we're doing now and let's have a look at how we can improve it. What can we do better? And the ideas that come out are fantastic. Just giving people the autonomy to be able to think like that, it's a fantastic tool. And it's such a practical tool that you can apply. You can apply it in the workplace. You can apply it at home. You can apply it in your personal life. There's always room for improvement in everything. Always. Nobody is ever at, you know, at, I don't know. I just feel there's always room for improvement in everything. And I'll leave it at that. I think. I'm going to move on to the last one. Neil, I'm going to pass over to you. This is your favourite.
It is. It's the concept
this is your
of
subject, Ikigai. And I want to spend the last 5 or 10 minutes, that last 5 or 10 minutes, allowing you to wax lyrical on this, because I know how much you love this.
I do. Now, this is a really interesting one. And the reason I say it's really interesting is because if you talk to somebody who is Japanese, they'll say, you got it wrong. There are two versions of this thing called Ikigai. So Ikigai. And if you want to search this up, if it resonates with you. Now, version one, okay, I'm going to tell you what we in the West think Ikigai is. Okay, so this is, if you can imagine this kind of perfect space where you're doing something you love, it happens to be something you're very good at, the world needs it, and you can be rewarded for it. Okay, so this is that perfect spot, almost this perfect storm. You love it, you're good at it, the world needs it, and you can be rewarded for it. So
now that's what I thought it was. This is the one I thought it was, and this is what I read up about in the book I read.
Absolutely.
So it's not this.
It's not this. It's not this at all.
But okay.
I say it's not this because, of course, it can be this. Because why wouldn't you want to do that? And of course, you would. So if you can be working in a role that you're very good at, because it draws on all your skills and all your preferences, it's the kind of thing the world needs right now, and actually, you can be rewarded for it too. Well, isn't that just a lovely thing? And you could imagine that that would be something you'd want to be doing every moment of every day. And this is now the version two, which is actually, from a Japanese perspective, the correct version of the word Ikigai, is because that gives you presence. What it means is that in every moment, you are doing something that just makes you feel that moment of just that pause, that little silence I just gave you, where you just feel in the moment. It just feels perfect. You get that moment of, and I guess in the West we would call this bliss. You know, you get that moment of bliss where it is just, it feels right. Your head's feeling it, your body's feeling it, and definitely your heart is feeling it. So for some people, it could be that moment first thing in the morning where you just are making that first coffee of the day and you smell the coffee beans and it just feels, that moment just feels right. That is Ikigai. It could be you stand outside and you just take that first breath of morning air. The sun is shining. You can hear the birds singing. The air is crisp. It hasn't been, you know, cluttered with the noise of the day. That moment is Ikigai. And the Japanese version of this is that if you can be practicing Ikigai, living in Ikigai, so being, not doing, being present, not doing lots of stuff, but being really, really present in every moment, then you're living your Ikigai. The Western version of it, of course, is that, but that must be doing something you love, that you're good at, you can be paid for,
so
the world
kind
needs.
Dave kind of took it one stage further because they need something to hang its hat on in the West. So they've got to say, it's got to be this, got to be that. And I guess, as you said, version one, if you're doing something you love and you're good at it and the world needs it and you get paid for it, I guess that could be that moment. But you're saying it's bigger than that. It can be the little things as well. It doesn't have to be that big.
Absolutely. And I think for me, and I've had this debate with a chap called Nick Kemp, who is the founder of Ikigai Tribe. And you can find it, if this resonates with you, you can find Ikigai Tribe on LinkedIn. And he talks a lot about this and has a real issue with the Western version of this. because he's done a lot of research. His wife is Japanese. He's lived in Japan. He spent a lot of time researching this and has created a global community around the true essence of Ikigai. And he and I have had a lot of conversations about this concept. And I've said, yeah, but surely isn't it okay, the other version, the Western version, because it is all from a place of the heart. It is all from doing it with love. And surely that's going to make you feel good too. And he will say, well, yes, it is. But then once you've kind of got into that space, then you can move into the real meaning of it. Then you can really extend into that every moment version of it. And I kind of get that. But I think all of us are on a journey. And I think, you know, I'm not quite there yet. I'm kind of dabbling with it, trying to build those habits. But there's an opportunity here for continuous improvement, going back to Kaizen, continuous improvement of your Ikigai. You need to explore it and find it first and understand really kind of what does make, and my wife often talks about, you know, the concept of what makes your heart sing. Because a lot of this you're going to feel. It's not about overthinking a lot of this stuff. Ikigai very much comes from the feeling that the things that you're doing and being evoke. And so a lot of this is very heart driven. So allowing your heart to speak, if you're meditating or if you're reflecting on, you know, your life and your world, it is about listening to the heart, not letting that chattering mind take over, because most of us do that bit.
Funny you should say that, because my LinkedIn post today had that quote in it. It made my heart sing. So there we go. Because something happened and it did make my heart sing.
Wow.
Right. Well, we are not saying that this is the right way to be, to live. What we're saying is maybe it's an alternative viewpoint. And Neil has very graciously and very ably done a very high level explanation as to what these five particular areas are. If any of them were new to you, or if any of them were interesting to you, perhaps you could go online and just do a little bit more research. I don't think anyone could go away and start applying all of those five things at once together. I don't know about you, Neil, but it's just having an understanding of them and thinking, maybe I could have a little go at this, or maybe I could be more this. And, you know, it's just being more mindful of what they mean and being more open to having a go.